Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? You're listening to Around the World with Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more on Around the World with Dan Perry. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. It's been a very long time, and I'm going to have to apologize for that. I haven't really thought too much about this podcast in a while, other than, do I keep it going? Do I just let it dwindle down? Do I maybe do one last hurrah episode? So I've kind of let it just lay dormant for a while, and I don't really have any great excuses other than to say, well, it's a travel podcast, and last year was really the reason I created the podcast, was to meet people while I'm traveling and talk to them and get their stories. And, well, I met quite a few people, and then Katie and I also did a bunch of episodes where we just hashed out what we thought of the country as we were leaving it. We tended to stay in each country for about a month as we traveled around Asia. And then on our last day, or maybe the first day in the next country, we would sit down and just talk about our thoughts on where we had just been and where we were going. And so things were going really well. It worked out great last year as far as keeping the podcast going, keeping my photography going, and just keeping my interesting online travel presence, I suppose you could say, in good shape. But now this year is different. Katie and I moved to Hong Kong in last August. I guess we've been here 6 months or whatever now, half a year, maybe more. And I guess anytime you move to a new country, new place, it takes a little while to adjust. And that's mostly what we've been doing, is adjusting here. We got moved into a new apartment, got all furniture for it, mostly used stuff, so we didn't spend too much money. And we're starting to build communities here, making some friends here and there, getting back into things like hiking and rock climbing and outdoor pursuits. It's really been a pretty smooth, easy transition as far as moving to a brand new country go. I've been to a lot of countries in Asia at this point, and really Hong Kong is by far the easiest one for me, at least, for adjusting from the culture that I'm used to. And by that I mean, well, first of all, it used to be an English colony, so most people here speak English. People are quite friendly in general here. They're really helpful when you need it. But then also it's just easy to get around. The public transportation system is excellent. And there's a lot to see and do here. There's a lot of nature in Hong Kong that maybe you wouldn't expect, because mostly when you see pictures of Hong Kong, it's of the central area with all the gleaming skyscrapers. Well, we actually live out in the countryside, so we live next to a big forest, and we were able to go hiking all the time. So that's pretty cool. And it's even beyond just getting away, or beyond adjusting to a new country, we don't even really have to adjust to this giant metropolis, which is Hong Kong, because we live out in the countryside. So that's all been going great. But the thing is, this year we haven't really focused on travel at all. In fact, other than a trip to Chongqing last fall, we haven't really even left Hong Kong. I think that'll change next year. We'll do a bit more traveling, but this is kind of an adjustment year, a year of moving to somewhere new and just really getting to know the place. And I guess that's the main reason why I haven't been recording new podcasts. I've just been focused on other stuff. But things are going well for us, so stay tuned. I think I will keep the podcast going, and you know, even though I don't have a big audience, that's not really the reason why I do this show. It's more because I enjoy it, and I still do enjoy it. And this very episode, it reminded me of why I enjoy this podcast so much. So let's get into that. I recently just opened my apartment up for couch surfers to come in. And I guess Couchsurfing is pretty well known at this point. But if you've never heard of it still, just very briefly, when you travel, most people would stay in a hotel or a hostel, which is fine. But sometimes you might want to get to meet local people. And what Couchsurfing lets you do is stay in a local person's house and get a taste of their lifestyle. And there's no money involved, so it's kind of like Airbnb, but you don't have that customer relationship that you would normally get in an Airbnb or in a hotel. So you meet people from all walks of life. Now, obviously, I'm not a local to Hong Kong. I just moved here 6 months ago, but I am living here, so I do know a little bit about the place. And I've just decided to start hosting people here and there, and Katie's happy to do that as well. She loves meeting new people. So our very first guest from Couchsurfing for this year in Hong Kong is my guest today. His name is Alec Hill, and he comes from the United States of America. It was really interesting hosting him because he, I guess in some ways he's like a more mature version of me when I was in my mid-20s. He is currently on an open-ended trip. He's going to travel all over the world, as you'll hear in our show. He's got really ambitious plans to go far and wide, and this is really his time to go and explore, which is awesome because meeting him really rehashed a lot of my old memories of traveling, especially in Asia, because he plans to travel to many Asian countries in the first part of his trip, at least. And just got me back into that mindset that I was in when I was in my mid-20s of just wanting to go everywhere, just always wanting to do new stuff all the time. But like I said, he's more mature than I was. He just has such a nice outlook on life that it took me quite a long time to develop, where he doesn't need to move fast. He doesn't need to see everything either. He's got this cool style of how he travels, which you'll definitely hear in the show. Well, I'm rambling a bit, so let's get into it right now. And I think stay tuned for more episodes of this show in the future. I might do a few just solo acts. I've got a few things I want to talk over related to travel. But hopefully I'll get some more guests on as well as I meet new people around Hong Kong and as I travel the world in the next year or two and travel around especially more of Asia in the years to come. All right, so without any further delay, after a six-month hiatus, let's get into the show and my episode with Alec Hill. Welcome to Hong Kong, Alec.
Thank you very much for talking to me and for hosting me in Saigon. I appreciate it.
Hey, no worries. You're our first couchsurfing guest here in Hong Kong, so much appreciated on our end as well.
Yeah, well, as you know, you're my second couchsurfing host ever, so I'm brand new, but enjoying it. It's been a fun way to learn about the city and to meet folks.
That's cool. Well, so it's going pretty well with, I guess you tell me about your first experience before we recorded.
Yeah.
And sound like not exactly ideal.
Yeah. I basically chalk it up to cultural differences. I flew into Hong Kong last week and stayed two nights with a woman who I had, you know, sent a request to on Couchsurfing, and she was great. She was super nice, but it was just a tiny apartment. And I don't think, it was strange. I think she wasn't really, she sort of admitted she wasn't really in the mood or the headspace to host, which didn't feel very fair to me because I had no idea of that going in, you know. But anyway, I just stayed 2 days with her in Chun Wan, and which is northwest of the city. It's in the city, accessible on the MTR. But anyway, that was just sort of my first start. And then I stayed at a hostel a few days in Kowloon and was just doing a lot of kind of like the low-hanging fruit in terms of tourism in Hong Kong. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but just checking out some of the museums, checking out the Temple Street Night Market, the Symphony of Lights, which was gorgeous, the Hong Kong Island skyline. Enjoying myself in the city. But then, actually, when I sent a request to you for this week, I had no idea where Sai Kung was.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I was just looking to extend my stay and stay with another couch surfing person. And so then, once we had a conversation, find out that it's pretty much fully outside of the city and right on the water and right with this big park in the backyard. So that was just kind of a happy surprise, I guess.
Totally. Yeah.
So it's been a good few days.
Did you get all that info from my profile, or did you like start looking it up once you saw that I was in Sai Kung?
I read your profile, and then I was just Google mapping around. And you know, when you're brand new to an area, you sort of have like a trouble with the sense of scale, you know. And so I was like, is this totally outside of the city, you know, or does it feel like a world away, or is it just kind of a suburb? And it's kind of both. It seems really accessible. I guess I'll figure out today how easy it is to get back when I go back to the city.
It's not too bad.
Yeah, yeah. But then, yeah, just sort of getting a feel for the area in advance, and then that doesn't really compare to actually going there, and that's when you start to learn about it, you know?
Sure, and even just looking it up on the map, I use a mapping app here for getting around, and it'll show how far it is from my house to, like, Mong Kok, and it's only, like, 8 miles.
Yeah, yeah, it's something a little
it's absurdly
hard
close
to grasp.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because it's a completely different world if you've never been out here.
Yeah.
Like, Mong Kok is so busy. I've heard it's the busiest, or most densely populated neighborhood in the world.
Yeah.
By some measurement anyway. And out here is just like countryside and with 8 miles in between.
Yeah. It's pretty striking. And then the way of just the layout of the terrain with all these little coves and then these mountains in between, that they're not massive mountains, but we can't see Hong Kong from here really, you know, whereas if it was flat, maybe we could, but, definitely feels hidden away.
Yeah, it's a nice little tucked away corner of Hong Kong. And I think when I think about Hong Kong, two big things define it as far as lifestyle here. One is really small apartments.
Yeah.
And then the other is that everything's super expensive.
Yeah.
And especially the housing. And that's why the apartments are so small.
Yeah.
So that like just really shapes the lifestyle here.
Yeah, I definitely got to experience the tiny apartment when I stayed in Chun Wan. Just really kind of ridiculous. Wouldn't be very fun to live in, but...
Right, those two things kind of don't go together, do they? Like, you've got the small apartment with the money thing, you really want to couch surf, right? Because you can save so much money. Whereas some countries, you do it for other reasons.
Yeah.
To meet people.
Yeah.
But the money is kind of not that... Like, I've even been in situations where I've spent more money couch surfing because I have to take a taxi way out somewhere and it's hard to get there. Whereas I could have just stayed in a hostel right in the middle of the city for less money than the taxi ride.
Yeah. I don't know if this will hold true at all, but my thinking right now is if I can couch surf 50% of the nights on my trip.
Oh, that many?
I mean, maybe. I mean, definitely not when I'm out in the middle of nowhere and just camping, you know. But couch surf or camp or stay somewhere where you're not getting charged by the night. And then do the other half in hostels. I mean, we'll see. But, I mean, just for example, on these 11 days in Hong Kong, I think it'll be 6 nights couch surfing and 5 nights in hostels. And just kind of... Yeah, it feels good to defray the costs and feel like you're making your money go longer on an open-ended trip where the length of the trip is defined by how long, you know, I can make it work financially.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. That's an important headspace to get into that I think people listening to this at home who have never done a long trip, maybe not, maybe they won't quite realize.
Yeah.
Like when you go on vacation for a week or two and you have a job, you don't want to spend all your money on the trip. You are conscious of money unless you're super rich, but
yeah. Well, it's just sort of bracketed. You're like, it's 10 or 11 or 12 days where maybe my normal habits wouldn't apply, and I'm going to spend, you know, much more just on daily activities than I would normally. And that's fine because you also, you know, you still have a job. I don't have a job.
Right. You have a job to come back to. And maybe you'd go out to eat once a week normally in your normal life, and now you're going out to eat seven times a week.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really matter in the long run for you because it's just for a week.
Yeah.
But for you, you're just going until the money runs out.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, what I'm trying to occupy is some kind of middle ground because kind of tight-fisted, miserable approach to it is not what I want either, you know, where I'm not allowing myself to indulge in the kind of joy and weird finds and discoveries that are what I'm looking for traveling, you know, just because I'm determined to hew to the most financially efficient path, you know, and not going out to eat, not going out for a beer with someone I just met. Like, that's not the way to do it.
No, I mean, if all you cared about was money, if that's the only thing, then you should just go to Bangladesh right now and just stay there the whole time.
Yeah, and move there.
Maybe go to India for a day to do a visa run and then go right back to Bangladesh.
Yeah. No, so it's not, it's not open-ended in that way of, I want to do this for the rest of my life without interruption, or I'm not, or like, or I never want to work again. You know, I'm sure the time will come, maybe even soon, maybe while I'm still in 2019, where I'm like, I need that that daily routine that work provides, even more than the money.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah, a bit of stability.
And the community in a new place, because the solo stuff, even so far, with a few months visiting friends in the U.S. before I left the country last Thursday, it's great, and it's really fun to just make up your own mind about where you're going and pack up your stuff and head off on your own. But I think over the long term, it saps you a little bit to not be in the flow of a larger group.
Yeah, I agree. And everybody's different a little bit, but I think you'll get a good feel for that as you keep going.
I hope so.
Yeah, the road can get quite lonely. But the cool thing is you can always just hunker down in like a hostel or go, like you said, work for a little while. I mean, there's no rules.
Yeah.
You can completely modify your trip midstream. So these are nice things to consider.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I'm really just kind of plotting out each subsequent step when I reach the step before that step, you know, so kind of assembling it as I go.
Yeah, one day at a time. And before we move on, I wanted to say with couch surfing, don't write off doing it in the middle of nowhere too.
Yeah,
it's weird, but
okay.
Here and there you're gonna find some guy who has a farm like out in the countryside.
Sure.
And it's like a really awesome place. And and you kind of have to look a little bit harder, because if you just search for Melbourne or just Hong Kong or whatever, the city name, it might not show up.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I guess getting a better idea of what the actual neighborhoods are, or the suburbs, or the different regions, within a blanket or umbrella category, like, you know, Greater Sydney, Australia or whatever. That's going to kind of... I mean, it reminds me of like trying to find the right size road hitchhiking, where you're like, if you're on a little dirt lane and there's nobody going by, and it's going to take you all day to get a ride. And then if you're on an interstate, you're also not going to get a ride. But finding that middle ground can be the most fun and the quickest.
Yeah, it's this weird paradox with hitchhiking where you get on the highway and there's tons of cars. None of them will stop.
Yeah.
And then... on a small road, though, I find every car stops.
Yeah.
If it's a little dirt road, you get it to a small enough road, but you might find a car like once a day.
Yeah. I don't know. I haven't done too much hitchhiking, but the little that I have done in California was kind of feast or famine, you know, and it was really fun. I met some really cool people, but
that's cool.
Had a day or two standing in the rain.
I had... I hosted some couch surfers in China once that had done a ton of hitchhiking to get out there. They had gone overland from like Germany, I think. Some by train, but a lot by hitching. But once they got to China, they realized that the thumbs up symbol of hitchhiking doesn't mean anything there.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's my vague sense that hitchhiking doesn't work as well in developing countries because you're asking for this free service and you're a Westerner and, you know, everybody becomes a taxi as soon as they see you on the side of the road, which I think is sort of blameless. Like,
it's totally fine.
Yeah.
It could go either way, though.
Okay.
In some countries that are poor, that's completely true. And someone might pick you up, but you'll have to pay them because why would they just take you for free?
Yeah.
But then other countries, it's completely normal to hitchhike, especially in a place where like 1 out of 1,000 people has a car.
Yeah.
That the locals use just hitchhike all the time.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's more of a shared resource. The car is viewed as a shared resource, even though one person owns it.
Uh-huh.
So they'll pick up just tons of people just on their way to work or whatever.
Do you have specific countries in mind?
Well, like in the Caribbean, I think that happens a lot.
Oh, very cool. You know? Very cool.
I think Cuba, it happens a lot too, although the legality of foreigners hitchhiking is a little bit of a gray zone.
Yeah, yeah. We'll see if I get there. Probably not for a while if I do.
Some other places like Guyana, I hitchhiked all across Guyana.
Wow.
On the back of these giant Bedford trucks.
Oh, man.
They would stop all the time and pick more people up.
Huh.
But again, it's the middle of nowhere, so it's one of these places you might wait for 2 hours just for a single vehicle to pass you.
Yeah, yeah. You got to take your shots. You got to really make a good impression on that vehicle.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
The China one, they actually had someone, like I think one of the border guards wrote a sign for them in Chinese. Not a sign, but a little piece of paper.
Yeah.
And they just ended up waving their arms at the first car to go by. And the guy thought that they're in trouble or something and stopped. And they just
show him the slip of paper.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just said, hey, we are so-and-so from Germany and we're trying to get to Beijing. Would you mind giving us a ride for some of it? And they got in.
Okay.
And the guy had a BMW and
nice.
Like drove him for like 6 hours or something.
Yeah.
So they made really good progress.
Yeah, there was a guy who's a Los Angeles County firefighter who gave me a ride from Santa Barbara to San Luis Obispo last month, and he was driving a BMW, and I just almost didn't stick my thumb out. I was like, this guy in a super nice car isn't going to pull over. Why would he? But he did, and he turned out to be awesome.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Thank you, Aaron.
All right. Shout out to Aaron. It's another thing to consider that rich people aren't all dicks, you know?
Yeah, like, truly. I don't think that.
That can be very nice. So let's talk about your trip. I wanted to know, you're traveling open-ended right now, just got started.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go back before that. What?
Yeah.
Take me back to like a year ago, 6 months ago. What's going through your head? Like, why are you planning the trip at that time?
No. I think that I was aware that this was something I wanted to do. But I wasn't planning because there was a lot of unknowns about when I would be able to complete my last job. I used to work at a literary magazine called the Swanee Review, based in Tennessee. And it was a really good job, and I wasn't really trying to leave it until it was a good breaking point to leave. So that didn't come till last December, and then I was in conversation to maybe apply for another job, and then that was sort of a fork in the road, because one thing driving me to do this travel now is a certain fear that if I take more steps in the direction of a career, because I've sort of dialed into what I want to do, which is writing, whether it be journalism or book publishing or that world. But I don't really want to rush into it, you know, because I'm scared that if I do, I wouldn't ever have the opportunity to travel like this. Now, why I wanted to travel, I don't know. It just seems like I would think I would feel sort of unfinished or unformed in some way if I didn't have some more direct experiential knowledge of the world. You know, not that it's about like acquiring a checklist of experiences, but I just think I would have felt somehow missing or ignorant in some way if I had just only ever lived in the States. And then it was, whoop, you know, I'm 30 and this is what I'm locked into doing. Not that it really works that way, but that was sort of my mindset. So I knew I wanted to travel. I was kind of waiting for the right window, trying to maneuver for the right time to leave my job. And the specifics of the trip unfolded in stages and changed a lot and really evolved. I thought I was going to go to New Zealand first. I thought I was going to go to Bali first. They're still on my list. I'll probably be going there in 2019. But it came down to hearing back about the job that I was waiting for, not getting it and saying, okay, where am I going? What's practical? What's cheap? And then like 10 or 15 days ago, buying a flight to Hong Kong. So now I'm in the stage of just like, okay, what is this? What am I doing? What's my like method, so to speak?
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so you were going for a different job. You didn't get that.
Mm-hmm.
Then you decided, okay, now's the time.
Mm-hmm.
You had enough money saved for a while and good to go.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the time the start of a trip does just come down to a plane ticket. And,
yeah.
And like, what's the best deal?
Yeah. I experienced some kind of nerves about it, which I didn't expect. And then right before I bought, and then once I had bought, I was like, oh, and then up to, you know, the day I flew, I was like, all right, you're really doing this. you know, you don't have to do it. Nobody's kind of telling you it's the right or wrong thing to do, which sort of, I think, falls under the larger heading of the challenges and thrills of just deciding for yourself.
Sure. And remind me again, you're in your mid-20s?
24. I'll be 25 at the end of May.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So here we are.
Uh-huh.
You bought that plane ticket.
Uh-huh.
One-way ticket, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. The best kind.
Yeah. Yeah.
The journey has begun.
Frankly, I hope I'd just keep moving west, country by country, month by month, until I'm in Europe in 2020 or 2021, and I feel kind of sheepish talking or making plans that far out because who knows what's going to happen. But then, you know, maybe like Iceland is the last stop, and then you go any further west and you're in New York, you know, you're back.
Yeah, right, right.
But that would be a fun way to end it.
Okay, could work out, but there's a lot of world in between.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is.
So, okay, so you're going to leave Hong Kong in a couple of days and go to Bali? Right?
Yes, I'm going to visit my cousin Becca and her husband Sean and their daughter Maeve in Bali on Monday, April 1st. April Fool's Day.
Wow.
Well, I don't know what that means.
It'll be a good gift for them.
Yeah. It's a total surprise.
It's not a 737 Max A, is
it? It's not. That'd be the bad kind of April Fool's
Day.
Yeah,
right. All right, well, cool.
Uh-huh.
I'm Bali excited. For a while, doing the Eat, Pray, Love thing?
Yeah, I guess so. Elizabeth Gilbert, I feel like that's like a book that's become a meme or sort of not well thought of, but I haven't read it. I kind of want to read it.
Yeah, I read it like 10 years ago.
Did you enjoy it?
Actually, yeah, it's really well written.
Yeah.
She's a very different person than me, but
mm-hmm.
She's a really good writer.
She wrote a book before that I believe was called The Last American Man, and is about this guy named, I think, Eustace Conway that this amazing teacher I had in high school gave to me, and that guy, it's sort of just a biography of this wild guy who lives in the Smoky Mountains in North Carolina, and he's just I mean, I don't know what he's doing now. I think this was written in the 90s, but he's just kind of this extreme survivalist. Anyway, it's a really good book. Anisha's a good writer. Maybe I will read Eat, Pray, Love. Who knows?
Well, if nothing else, you'll probably find it on a bookshelf in a hostel at some point.
Yeah. So many copies airport of the book. Bookshelves. Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, there too, but then you're going to pay more than the retail value. But
yeah,
quite often, I don't. I guess I haven't really checked on this lately, but it used to be that hostels tended to have book exchanges. And you just bring one and you take one. Sometimes you have to pay a dollar or something to exchange.
Mm. The one in Kowloon last week did not, but I will look for the others. Though I'm not really reading paper books at the moment. That was sort of a thing I had to stop doing just because you can't really carry them. You know, you can't. I'm trying to, you know, read a lot. I love to read. So I have got a Kindle and use that, and it's easy.
It's just funny because we're almost from different generations, actually, because when I was traveling as a younger person, there were no e-books, so the idea that you couldn't carry a book was kind of crazy. Everyone carried a book or two.
Yeah, I'm obsessive and curatorial with my book selection, though, and most books that I buy, I want to keep, and I can't be hauling around crates of books, you know.
No, you don't want to do that.
Though I see the appeal of reading it and dropping it wherever you finish it, and then someone else picks it up, and these books kind of make the rounds.
Sometimes people will sign their name at the beginning and just sign where they got it and where they're dropping it off.
Oh, that's cool.
So you
can
kind of gauge the journey of the book.
Yeah. I imagine some of these books just get destroyed too, in kind of a cool way, like they're battered.
Yeah, they've got character. And Paul Theroux, one of my favorite authors, he travels all the time by train. We talked about him a little bit. But I get the feeling like when he's traveling, he's got a duffel bag. I mean, just from his writing, it seems this way. He's got a duffel bag with like 8 books in it and maybe a change of clothes and a pad of paper and pen.
Yeah.
And that's all he travels with.
Yeah, that sounds like the right ratio of books to other possessions. Is he still doing it? How old is he?
Yeah, he's probably close to 80 by now.
Okay.
And I just heard an interview with him maybe 6 months ago. He was driving around Mexico and just exploring Mexico on his own. And
very cool.
And he's just gotten really into it.
Yeah, I'm familiar with his stuff, but I haven't read any of his books. I think I've read shorter journalism and maybe some short stories by him, but I like his stuff.
Oh, okay. Well, two that might interest you on this particular journey. Well, his classic one was The Great Railway Bazaar.
Okay, yeah, I've heard of that.
And that was the early 70s.
Where is that set?
Well, he starts in London in his home.
Yeah.
Goes across Europe. Almost the entire book's by train, but he had to fly a few times. Then he went through the Middle East, he went through Iran, he went into India, all the way across Southeast Asia to, I think, to Japan, and then took the Trans-Siberian Railway back home. Back to Moscow, and then back to, through Poland. And that, so that was done, again, during, well, like the Soviet Union was around.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Sri Lanka was still called Ceylon back then, and you know, there's like,
yeah,
a lot has changed. It was Myanmar was still Burma, like things like that. And then about, I guess it'd be 40 years went by, and that's the book that really made him big in the travel writing industry. And then he, 40 years later, roughly, he decided to redo that trip.
Wow.
Yeah, and tried to go to the same spots, although it wasn't always possible.
Yeah.
Like some countries became easier to get into, some became harder.
Yeah.
Like I think Iran wouldn't let him in because he had said some bad things about them.
Yeah, I would read that just to figure out how he passed through Eastern Europe, you know, and those former, or those at the time present USSR republics. I feel like geopolitics seems like this huge looming presence that determines what you can and can't do in a very stark way. And I'm sure in some cases it is that way, you know, and you need to do your research. But at the same time, it's cool to remember that, you know, daily life goes on in all of these places, you know, and geopolitics may not necessarily even enter into, you know, some little backwater village where, you know, people aren't necessarily dialed in that way.
Right.
And so seeing those places is sort of still doable, I guess.
Yeah, right. And I mean, people are still people, mm-hmm. no matter where you go.
Yeah.
Their
yeah.
governments change.
Yeah.
For better or worse. Mm-hmm. Right. And there are still some spots where it's a little harder to get to, like visa wise.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no, I'm absolutely not saying that you can just kind of throw caution to the wind, but,
More or less you can.
Yeah. Okay.
which we could probably get into that too. I think one of our goals for this podcast was to get some ideas for you where to go and how to get there.
Uh-huh.
So throw out any questions as you have them, because I've been to a lot of the places that you want to go.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've basically got a rough idea. Just yesterday I was sort of sketching out, okay, what could the rest of 2019 look like? And it could look like Bali for the first half of April, and then Australia for 2.5 to 3 months, and then my visa to Australia is limited to 3 months stays, so I could go there through mid-July, and maybe I wouldn't be done with the country at that time, and I'd want to hop out and then come back and keep exploring. But assuming I kind of do a first 3 month trip through Australia, then in the midsummer I might loop back to Southeast Asia and do some kind of loop through Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand, mid-July to say mid-September. I may be signing up for just a total kind of monsoon, humid sufferfest.
Yeah, right.
It seems, I just really haven't done my research about it yet. But then I think I would probably go, assuming I do that, then I would maybe go to Japan for a month or 2 months. I have a buddy who's going to be in Tokyo for the Rugby World Cup in the third or fourth week of September. So base a trip around seeing him and hanging out with him while he's there, but also leave Tokyo, see some of the countryside, go up to the north and down to the south and so on. And then what would next be on my list? I want to say then maybe go to India in the fall for 3 months or 4 months. And then you're at the end of 2019, and we'll see where I'm doing in terms of my wallet at that point. But both for fun and maybe for some money, I have this idea that it'd be fun to go work a wine harvest in New Zealand or Australia maybe. And so that would be their fall, really happening right now, you know, February, March, April of next year.
Also be a year from now that you go.
Mm-hmm, yeah. This with the caveat that who knows how it's actually going to shake out. But that's my thought. That covers the first half of... through the first half of 2020, you know, to June 2020 maybe. And then where I've just sort of like put a cork in it and I'll figure it out once all of that shakes out is further west, the Middle East, the safe parts of the Middle East that I could visit. And then maybe from a place like Israel, go down into Egypt, work my way down into Eastern Africa. So many countries I want to see. And then like kind of make it a big U and go up through parts of the west coast of Africa. Through Namibia and Angola, and maybe see parts of Nigeria, and then, you know, then you're in West Africa and you continue around to Morocco and then Europe, and then that would probably be the last stretch. So that's, you know, that's sort of light on specifics, you know, that's like a country by country sequence.
And once you start considering all the countries that are out there and you just say, oh, I'll just go there for a month or that one for 2 months, quickly turns into like 5 years or more.
Yeah, yeah. You realize like, oh my God, this is going to take up some time. But but you want to do it right. Not that there's a right or wrong way to do it, but you want to not do it in a superficial way, but slow down, do more than just the most obvious things, leave yourself time to discover things that you wouldn't have known about, you know, just because the twists and turns and surprises of how this all turns out, you know, like for me, a trip to Hong Kong turned out to be in large part a trip to Saigon, you know, which is a place I didn't know existed a week ago, you know.
Yeah, and that's going to happen over and over.
I can't wait for it to happen, you know. That's just a really fun part. I mean, Saigon will maybe be the main takeaway of this, just this little first stop in Asia, you know. So I want time for that, you know. I don't want to hurry. And, you know, we were talking the other day and you mentioned, well, if you want to travel your whole life, which I do, then you don't need to be exhaustive about things, you know. And you don't need to hit every item on every checklist. And I think that's good to remember and keep front and center, because I'd rather really kind of sink my roots into a few places than feel hurried or obliged to move on for the sake of getting things done, you know, or getting somewhere new.
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings back this memory of when I was traveling by myself in South America. Sometimes I'd meet people who had a round the world ticket.
Yeah.
And so the way these work, for people who don't know, they're not that expensive, really, when you consider what you get out of it. They're maybe $3,000 roughly. And you get to fly all the way around the world, and you pick, I think, like 3 or 4 continents. And then within each continent, you get 3 or 4 flights, just one-way flights, and it's all standby, so you just have to let them know a day or two before you fly, and it tends to be with just one airline or one group of airlines. So a lot of people will do that, and they'll travel around the world for a year, and they'll make a complete circle. And so I've met a number of people who've done it, and the ones who I met who were near the beginning of their trip, they were really gung-ho. They're like, oh yeah, this is my year, I'm gonna see the world, I'm gonna do it, this is my whole thing. My whole life is packed into this 1 year. And then if I met people who were at the end of their trip, their attitude was very different. It was like, it was either, oh my God, I can't do another flight. Every week I'm flying somewhere and I can't keep it all in my head.
Yeah.
Either that or more like, okay, now this year has been a good year for me to see a few countries. And now in the future, I want to take more time off to go back to some of these places, to some of the ones I really liked, and really get to see them, not just superficially.
Well, you've been a big advocate of going overland wherever possible, you know, by train or by bus, and where it's safe and practical, I'd love to do that. I think for money reasons and for kind of not applying a tourniquet to one experience and separating it from what happens next, but letting the one flow into the other. I'm in Southeast Asia and in this kind of island corner of the world, you know, and I'm going to be taking a lot of flights, but where practical, I mean, it'd be amazing to go Egypt to South Africa overland.
Yeah. Yeah. That was another Paul Theroux book, actually.
Really?
Yeah, Dark Star Safari.
Dark Star really Safari. Good. Okay. Okay.
I don't remember if he flew at all during that one, but if he did, it was just short flights over some impractical places.
Yeah.
But right, much of the world you can cover over land.
Uh-huh.
And I remember a few years back, I went with a few friends. We did a road trip from Wisconsin out to California. And I remember thinking, like, oh yeah, these are connected, and like you can just drive. You just get in your car and you go through two, three tanks of gas.
Yeah.
And then you're in California.
Yeah.
And you really get to see what's in between, you know, when you're driving or when you're on land, in a way that you just don't when you're flying.
Yeah, I've done a few trips from Philadelphia to Colorado or California, or from Tennessee to Colorado, and it's definitely fun. It's kind of terminally boring at points, you know, when you're in Oklahoma in the middle of the night or wherever. Yeah. But yeah, it's definitely worth doing. We just have a funny shape to our, you know, our country, where there's a bunch of interesting stuff separated by a wide, flat expanse.
That's
which
true.
I don't mean to totally write off. You know, I like
yeah
areas in there as well.
But it's fun to just like get really caffeinated on those long drives and just let your mind wander for 8 hours straight.
Yeah, I used to have a minivan that was sort of my kind of like main tool for doing that. I took the seats out of the back and would just sleep in the Walmart parking lots here and there. And yeah, it's fun.
Cool. What was I going to say? It's something about road trips. Oh, I actually started taking things one step further in South America, where it's there's not really many trains in South America. There's only a couple, but there's buses everywhere. And at one point, at the beginning, if I had an 8 hour or let's say 10 hour bus ride, I would always go at night.
Yeah.
With the thought that, okay, I'm saving on a night's accommodation.
And you can sleep.
Yeah. I can sleep on the bus. I don't have to waste my time. I don't have to waste a whole day on a bus. I just get on the bus. It's like a movie in a hotel room.
Yep.
I wake up and I'm good to go for my next destination. Mm-hmm. I mean, you never get that good of sleep on buses.
Yeah.
That's the thought. But then later on, I started changing my mind really and started going during the day just to see the scenery. And
it's
like, I no longer viewed it as a wasted day when I'm looking out the window all day and seeing what's going by.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's just a rest day, you know, a day where, like, for example, today I'm going back to the city and there's a bunch of stuff I want to do on Hong Kong Island over the weekend, but probably not going to do that much today, you know, besides get to my hostel and do some laundry and buy some food, you know? And so rest days here and there are you know, great. And a kind of scenic rest day on a bus isn't so bad.
It's funny because your attitude is just so good. It's so like, it's you, where you are mentally is where it took me like 6 months to get there.
Oh, okay. You know,
because I always wanted to just go and like,
yeah,
stuff that I would treat my long trip like it was vacation. Like I've got a week and then I have to go back to normal life. So I want to do as much stuff as I can in the short amount of time.
Yeah. And yeah, I think it's natural.
Even
though
I knew I had an open-ended trip. I knew I was going to be gone for years, but I still just wanted to do like 20 things every day.
Yeah. Yeah. In a weird way, this trip is only half about all of the places I'm going. Which is not because I'm unenthusiastic about all of these new places, you know, or the kind of fun, exciting things to do there. But there's this other half for me, which is just kind of getting in a daily routine that sort of I determine, you know, how it's shaped, and feeling good and doing that right, is as important to me as jumping into kind of action-packed days day after day. So, I mean, specifically, I'm trying to use this as a period where I'm figuring out how to write my own material, fiction, nonfiction, writing in my journal, whatever, you know. Reading a lot and writing a lot is probably equally as important to me on this journey as is all of the places I'm going, because time is super valuable. And as I said, I worked in the publishing magazine industry for a little bit. I figured out I really like to do it and I want to do it, but my own writing career, my own sense of something to say, my own voice is still in toddler stage at best, you know? So this time this kind of privilege of time to not work. I mean, that's amazing, you know, and that is super important to me, that I don't squander it on that half of, you know, what I'm passionate about. In addition to and kind of counterbalancing getting out the door. I mean, even the last few days that I've been here, I haven't gotten out of the door until after lunch, you know, and those morning. And I mean, I think mentally over the long haul, that might be great. You know, you do some hibernating, some sort of internal work in addition to going out and just being kind of a sponge for experience.
Yeah, I think it's important on those long trips, like what you're doing with not going out all the time, like I just said. And that'll become even more evident in louder countries, in countries where it's just more chaotic.
Yeah.
Like in India, Katie and I were spent a long time there, and whenever we were in a city, I mean, if we went outside before noon, we're just so exhausted by 2 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Right, because there's just horns honking everywhere, there's cars zooming by, you're constantly looking out, trying not to get hit.
You've got
people coming up and talking to you, and it's a really valuable experience. It's really rewarding traveling in India, but it's also just exhausting.
Yeah, I mean, I think new places are intense.
Yeah.
Even boring new places are intense because they're unfamiliar.
Yeah.
New places that are intense on their own, you know, it's exponential.
And Hong Kong is actually quite easy on the world scale as far as travel, because everything's written in English. Mm-hmm. People tend to speak English here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's been a great, great kind of shallow end of the pool to enter into at first. I mean, I think the first several places are going to be like that. Bali, I think, is, you know, super tourist friendly. Australia, New Zealand, Thailand, you know, and then we'll see after that. I think so much of the world just kind of caters to English language and folks with money, and it's like, none of it's impossible, I guess.
Yeah, well, right, speaking English, I really do like languages. Mm-hmm. I'm into learning new languages.
Yeah.
But I also realize, like, English is by far the most important worldwide language.
Huh.
So if you're just able to understand this podcast, you already have this great tool that will help you.
Well, you have English and Spanish, so I wonder, out of 7 or 8 billion folks on the planet, I wonder what portion of the pie chart speaks one or the other. I wouldn't be surprised if it's half or more than half.
Oh, as far as knows it as a second language, yeah, it's got to be at least half.
Yeah, so then you can speak to most folks.
Probably.
You know?
And then when you throw in Chinese,
that
those three, I mean, China is more isolated to within China, but Chinese, I mean, is.
Mm-hmm.
But that's 1 out of every 6 people in the world is Chinese.
Yeah.
So that's a huge percentage of the population.
Yeah, that gets you pretty far.
Yep.
Yeah, my language skills are weak, but I would like to also use this trip to sort of rehabilitate my French and maybe stop in France, stop and live there for a little while. I mean, that'd be way down the road, but if you have more discipline than I have, I'm sure I could get back to pretty good on my own, but also just being immersed in it, I think, is a huge leg up.
It really helps. I remember with Spanish, even when I first went to South America, it had been a long time since I'd used it, and I was still kind of hesitant. I still didn't think I was really fluent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, just something flipped one day. I was like, oh yeah, I don't even have to like think about this anymore.
Yeah, did you notice those things people talk about, like you just started to think in it and you weren't translating it and you were dreaming in Spanish
and
so on?
All of it. Yeah. Yeah, just
that's so
just
cool. I've never experienced that. I'd crave that ability.
Yeah, it's really nice. But it took years of practice to get there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It hasn't gotten there with Chinese still. Although I think I'm on the cusp, though. It's weird because the language thing for me, at least, is you start learning, you get kind of conversational, intermediate.
Yeah.
But you still go through this struggle of, God, I just can't understand what he's saying. I wish I knew. And
yeah.
How, and just really racking your brains. It's just mentally just so strenuous to try to understand.
Yeah.
And just when you think you're never going to learn it, all of a sudden it just, you go, I guess I do know it.
It starts to click.
Yeah. It's weird.
Yeah. Wow.
It's weird. Not that I understand every word of Spanish, mm-hmm. There's especially slang words, and there's so many different regional differences. But the gist of it is, yeah, I think I could just go up to any native speaker and mm-hmm. just start talking to them. And that's a cool feeling.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's an inflection point that you hit where you understand more than you don't.
Yeah, it must be.
You know, and then the puzzle pieces start to lock together, you know, and yeah. There could be puzzle pieces missing, even many puzzle pieces missing. But like you can see the shape of whatever it is someone's talking about.
Right. And once you get to the point where someone can explain to you in that language what the word, like maybe you don't know a word.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Right. And then you go, hey, what's this word mean? And then they can tell you what it means, mm-hmm. but using their own language.
Yeah.
That, I think that's where the words just start flowing in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because now you can just learn new
words.
And
making up for one another, you know, and those workarounds.
Right.
That's really cool. I feel like it's got to be one of the best things you can do for your brain is just put it through the jungle gym of learning a language, using two different languages in a day, you know? I mean, already... I mean, initially going into this trip, I was just sort of embarrassed to just be like, yeah, you're going out, you only speak one language, you know, like you're just kind of presuming on everybody you meet that they have, you know, I mean, everybody speaks two languages in the world. Everybody is multilingual except
the Chinese.
You know, the people. Okay, yeah, fair. Well, I mean, so I think I still feel that, you know, and I'm kind of like, I want to learn a few words in the languages of the places I go just to kind of demonstrate some courtesy to, you know, the bus drivers and the people at the cash registers that I pass along the way. But also, I don't know, even already in the last week I've heard it's more than just like everybody speaks Cantonese and I speak English. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's a very simplistic way to look at it. And I was hearing multiple languages, you know, right. and I mean, right. Western languages, Europeans, other tourists, but also just other folks from Southeast Asia, you know, speaking, not able to speak Chinese. And so I sort of like realized like it's a big soup and you're in it and you only speak English. And if you can learn another language, great, but it's not like so all or nothing or so dualistic, correct. You know?
Yeah, Hong Kong is a very international territory, mm-hmm. and if you first come here and you've never been to Asia, you might not be able to tell listening to the languages apart. You might not be able to tell them apart.
Yeah.
Also, people's faces, you might not be able to tell the differences of different ethnicities.
Uh huh.
But over time, you can start to see those differences, and you realize, oh my God, there's a ton of people here who look Asian. I mean, the first thing you think is they look Asian.
Yeah.
You've never been to Asia.
Uh-huh.
But then you start realizing, oh, they're not from here either.
They're Indonesian or whatever.
Right. That person's Indonesian. And that language is completely different than Cantonese. It doesn't sound anything at all like it.
Yeah. Which is such a dividend of travel. That is one of the prime rewards of the experience itself, I think. Not because it makes you seem like less of a jerk, though it does. Mm-hmm. It's good to understand those differences. But also just because, yeah, the world is way more nuanced than, I mean, it's just such like a crude way to look at it when you don't have any experience of these gradations, you know, of, like, actually there's a lot going on, you know, not just one or the other.
A lot. I actually have this theory that the world is fractal, the whole world is. And when you first look at, when you grow up, or if you never travel anywhere, you just know your own little bit of it, and you maybe learn where the continents are, let's say, and that's kind of what you have in your head, placed in your head, these are the continents, and then you go to one of those continents, you zoom in a little bit and you start learning where the countries are, and then you zoom in a little bit and you start learning where the cities are and the neighborhoods are, but you can just keep going in and going deeper and deeper and deeper. And no matter how much you travel in a place, like you could just stay in Hong Kong your whole life, and travel, and you won't get to see every single little square inch of Hong Kong. You'll still find new stuff constantly. The deeper you look, you're just always going to have new things coming at you, new layers of complexity.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I think it's, beautiful to think about fractals, applied in that way. I think it's also true on a literal level. We do that with technology. You said zoom in, and we do that on Google Maps, literally.
Right,
and sometimes
yeah.
I think that affects how we think, or how we picture the world. Not necessarily in a bad way. I think it's just that the two have sort of grown together, and our picture of the world is a top-down, zoom-in, click-and-drag kind of way of interfacing with how the world's arranged.
Right. Another interesting thing you might see, depending on which countries you go to, is how different societies view their place in the world through the maps that they make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so when you're in China and you look at a map of the world, China's right in the middle, which I think doesn't really make any sense because the whole Pacific Ocean is taking like half of the map up.
Sure.
Right?
I mean, depends how you want to define making sense. I mean,
right.
They're the ones who made the map, so it makes perfect sense. I mean, or how does it make sense to put anywhere on a sphere at the center of a flat projection?
Correct. Yeah. You know? It's just, to me, probably the best spots to have at the edges would be the ocean where it's all stretched out.
Well, that's right. Very prejudiced against, the whales and the dolphins.
And those ocean people. Those 35 people who live on some little island.
Yeah, yeah. Those micronations.
Right at the edge of the map.
But
like at my last job, where my first job I had, there was a big map of the world on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States was right in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
But that meant that the edges were Asia. And so India was on the map twice, on the left side and the right side.
Yeah, yeah.
Because otherwise the map would just be split right down the middle of India.
Yeah.
So that seems equally bad.
I think we should just bring globes back. Globes are fun.
Just
they're
hard. Carry them
they're not practical to carry around, not for travel. But just like a globe, globe should be in every house.
Sure. Yeah. But we might get there again, though, with augmented reality, where you can put on glasses. And I mean, it won't just be for this. It'll be for many things. But you could have a virtual globe.
Yeah, okay.
That you could look at. And it's actually round.
Yeah. And presumably you could twirl it around and zoom in and kind of apply the Google Maps surface over what seems like a 3D object.
Correct. Yeah. And that could be it could be on your wall instead of the map. The globe is on your wall hanging out there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of course, you are making a big assumption that the Earth is round.
I'm not, in fact. Let's not go there. Let's not go in the direction of flat Earth or a hollow Earth.
A hollow Earth.
Conspiracy. Yeah.
I am pretty sure it's round, though, because when I call home at night, it's daytime there.
Well, you've been to Antarctica as well, right?
Yeah, I've seen the
bottom
wall.
Of the world.
I've seen the ice wall.
You've seen where the map ends.
Yeah, right.
Doesn't load.
Walked
after
off
that.
The edge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
It doesn't render after.
Right.
That.
You just start seeing green triangles in the distance. You're like, what the hell is that?
Uh-huh.
I'm getting out of here. Right. Or it's like, what was that movie with Jim Carrey where?
The Truman Show.
Yeah, the Truman Show. Like, you try to go to the edge and just storms start happening and pushing you back and they'll never let you get there. Right.
Yeah.
To be fair, though, I've only been to the peninsula of Antarctica, so I haven't quite gone all the way to the edge of the world.
Yeah, so you went down from Tierra del Fuego?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a really, really awesome.
I was having a fantasy the other day about like meeting some climate scientists like in South Island, New Zealand, or like meeting some meteorologists, and they'll be like, hey, you should come on our boat and come to Antarctica, or like go to McMurdo or something. And so yeah, I'm definitely going to be chatting up anyone who looks like a meteorologist in New Zealand, try to go to Antarctica.
Hey, it's possible.
Probably does not happen.
Well, the thing is, they do need cooks. And they
need
people to cook their food. They need janitors. They need workers. And
I'd be willing to lie about my cooking skills.
And there's a lot of people who are willing to go because they want to see Antarctica. So they'll go and live in these bases and do menial jobs.
Are you talking about on like science expeditions, or are you talking about like cruises or?
No, I mean like McMurdo and these other scientific bases that exist on
Is there a minimum stint? Is it like you got to go for 6 months?
Well, I don't know specifically, but maybe you could just do 3 months.
That'd be so freaking cool.
Well, there's very few people in Antarctica during the winter.
Yeah, or so, ever.
Yeah, well, ever, right.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's probably only a few thousand ever, but it's probably just a few dozen in the winter.
Sure.
Whatever, you know?
Yeah. Dang, that'd be cool. I'd put you in a weird mental space to set up a daily routine in Antarctica, you know, just right. Against kind of that blank.
Mm. With that landscape and with the whiteouts that can happen, and like you can't go to the bathroom outside or something, like you want to go for a walk, even just a 5 minute walk could kill you because whiteout happens, you get lost,
yeah,
you die.
There was an incredible piece of writing that is on that subject that you might enjoy. It's called The White Darkness. It's by David Gran, who wrote...
Oh, yeah, The Lost City of Z.
The Lost City of Z, and then more recently a book called Killers of the Flower Moon, I think. I haven't read his books, but this article, which came out a year or two ago, is about a guy who's obsessed with Ernest Shackleton. And
yeah, I kind of am too.
Yeah, he seems like an amazing guy, an amazing story. But this guy was determined to sort of complete some of the journeys that Shackleton had to turn back from. And he was determined to push, do a self-supported walk across Antarctica alone.
Mm-hmm.
Very long, kind of epic in the old-fashioned way, kind of adventure story.
Yeah.
That you see less of now because the world is so mapped and categorized, you know.
You do, and it looks different than it used to.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I don't know if you read this, two different people just did precisely that. They walked across Antarctica.
Yeah, well, not to spoil it, but this guy died at the end, so...
Oh, damn it.
Sorry. But yeah, so he...
Different guy then.
He didn't make it, and I think those two that you just mentioned were the first to complete it successfully.
Yeah, yeah. As far as there's a lot of asterisks that go at with this, or a lot of stuff gets added on. You have to be unsupported, so no one can drop food off for you in the middle of it, because other people have done that, gone with food and stuff.
Yeah.
And then unaided, so you can't use a kite, for example, to help you... with the wind to help you pull you across.
Yeah.
You have to just be your own muscles doing
it.
So they're pulling these sleds by themselves.
Uh-huh.
Right. And it's...
And I mean, if they're with each other, then it wasn't or perfectly solo.
They weren't. It was a kind of a race.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, those artificial constraints are funny. You know, I don't really have a problem with them, but I don't feel super... captivated or drawn by them, you know. I mean, we have kite technology. That'd be pretty fun to go across on a kite, you know. It's just a different experience, obviously.
Right. And I think it's more, it's almost not even about Antarctica at some point. It's just more like what is the human body capable of? And just to think, you know, you're burning 12,000 calories a day.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a lot.
Yeah.
Right. So you need 12,000 calories worth of food a day to carry with you. But if you do that, then it gets 400 pounds.
Yeah.
And so you have to, I heard an interview with the American guy who did it. He said, well, they had to, if they had given him enough food to sustain himself, there's no way he possibly could have moved the sled.
Yeah.
So he had to starve himself.
Yeah. Well, so that's definitely interesting. Those things where we are aware at the outset that the equation doesn't add up or isn't really solvable. You know, I mean, I feel like it's the case with solo sailing races around the world, specifically with the battle against sleep, you know, and the less you sleep, the more you are going to be successful, you know, and like it just demands your attention and you can't really sleep more than a little bit at a time. And even that can be interrupted just if the weather or the wind shifts.
Yeah.
But if you draw on that account of like your body's sleep health too recklessly, you'll also just crash and like sleep for 3 days, and then you're you're screwed, because I think these races are just kind of, they operate on crazy narrow margins. You know?
You're like Icarus flying too close
exactly,
to the sun.
Exactly. Yeah. So I mean, that's super interesting, but also by interesting I mean kind of disgusting and terrifying and
all of it. Yeah. That's why it's so interesting.
Yeah.
It is. I actually met this guy once in Australia who, well, he was just traveling there, I guess, but he's done a lot of work with the Ride Across America. I think that's all it's called, is RAM, Ride Across America, which is a bicycle race.
I've heard of this.
From the West Coast to the East Coast.
Yeah.
And it takes like 7 days.
Yeah, that's quick. That's and, what? That's like right. 300 miles a day.
Yeah, and if you look at like the miles per hour, it's not really impressive. They're not going as fast as the Tour de France riders.
Sure.
But they're pushing themselves for seven days straight, and they'll sleep for 15 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
You know, and a guy fell asleep on his bike a few years ago and got hit by a car and died.
Yeah, no, right? Yeah, like, these are definitely people who struggle to adjust their relationship to like, you know, normal like modes of exertion. I mean, I just think that's wild.
Yeah. And it's another one of those where you do need to sleep sometimes, but you have to keep it at very short stints.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean it's like sort of what they're out there to achieve is like some state of hallucination, you know, and
yeah,
that's sort
it
of
is.
Part
it
of
is.
The texture that they're going for.
Actually, bringing it back to Antarctica briefly, Ed Hillary was the first to climb Mount Everest, right? And he also was, I forget exactly the asterisks that go with this, but I think he was the second person or third person to make it to the South Pole also. Because the first two were Scott and Amundsen in, what year was that? 1912, I think?
Yeah, like way back when.
And in the 40s, or it might have even been 1950s. 1950s, I think. It went, that much time went before anyone else made it to the South Pole.
Yeah.
I think maybe people had flown there by then and had established a base of
would
sorts.
They would land?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there was already some sort of permanent base set up in the 50s in the South Pole, but no one had ever gone over land to get there. And so Ed Hillary did that. Anyway, his son, Peter, is also an adventurer. And he decided in the late 90s he was going to try to repeat Shackleton's repeat Scott's journey with a couple other guys.
Yeah.
And so they got these three world-class adventurers together and
did
it. And he wrote this memoir about it. And it's really good.
Henry Worsley, he was a Brit. He was the subject of David Grand's article. He may have been involved in that. He had done a lot of different expeditions and sort of extreme feats, including, now that you mention it, I think reproducing Ernest Shackleton's route to get back to Elephant Island, or, you know, his kind of epic journey of the endurance.
Wasn't Worsley one of the, wasn't he like the navigator on Shackleton's ship? Worsley, that sounds familiar.
I'm not sure.
Maybe it's
this guy is like a present day.
Oh, maybe it's his grandson or something. Who
yeah,
knows?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Oh, okay. Anyway, Peter Hillary, that expedition, his mom died in a plane crash, and I think it was maybe his sister died in a plane crash too. Don't quote me on that, but he had some people really close to him die, and during this trip, because you just see white to the horizon.
Yeah,
it's just flat. There's complete sensory deprivation.
Yeah.
So he started hallucinating over time and walking with his mom, and he had all these conversations with her, and so a lot of the book was based on that.
Jeez.
Yeah. And like, I think on some level he always knew it wasn't really her, but he could completely see her and talk to her.
Yeah, I mean, this is gonna sound goofy, but I don't think that's less real, you know. I mean, hallucinations are real.
Interesting.
I think conversations, whether, you know, waking or in sleep with people that maybe not physically there, are still a category of reality, you know?
Well, it's real for you, I guess.
Yeah.
Put it that way.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. We've been going for over an hour.
Okay.
So we could wrap it up.
All right, yeah. Hallucinations are a good spot to end on.
Yeah. Thanks once again to my guest, Alec Hill, for coming on the show, and I wish him well on his journey. I hope I get to catch him on the flip side after he visits Australia and New Zealand and heads back north again. And thank you for listening. For more information about Alec Hill and all the stuff we talked about today, including those cool Antarctic expeditions, you can always go to my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. Thanks once again, and I'll catch you next time.